problems with deans and notably Johnson. Will you elaborate on that, Johnson in particular?
Well, that's a long, long, long story.
Well, let's have what you can recall.
When he was elected to be the dean, there was a considerable amount of repercussion on the part of some of the faculty people.
Why?
Because Professor Edward Bennett was one of the very strenuous objectors, due to the fact, I suppose, that he had first-hand knowledge about what Johnson had done at Iowa State and at Missouri, where he was dean. And it didn't quite fit in with Bennett's conception of what a dean should be, so he came here with some doubts on the part of some of the faculty. Some of the other people in the faculty didn't know very much about this particular individual, and of course they didn't have their interest aroused particularly until the first faculty meeting, when he made the statement after bringing in a box of apples to give to the faculty. He made the statement that he was glad there was such a good turnout today at the faculty meeting, because next year half of you wouldn't be here.
What was his reason for that, saying that?
I think that was the item that aroused a lot of interest on the part of the faculty, which resented in very strenuous objection to a lot of the things he advocated and did.
Why did he advocate, and why did he feel he could say that half the faculty wouldn't be here?
So I told him at one time when I went in to see him that there were some things he wanted to do that just couldn't be done at the university. He told, I don't know whether he told me or whether he told the committee, that he had been told by Mr. Dykstra he could hire and fire anybody he wanted to.
Whether they had tenure or not?
I don't think he knew very much about the tenure situation.
I see.
And the faculty, I think in general, although not all of them, faculty in general got the idea that he was working against them. And they didn't feel too enthused about some of the things he advocated or some of the things he tried to do. And it was a long, drawn-out affair that we had to contend with.
You mentioned earlier that in connection with this in some way, that Dykstra's attitude towards the Department of Engineering.
Well, it was specifically against engineers, but he didn't have much love for the College of Engineering.
Have you any idea why this was?
Well, he was, I tried to find out by talking to some of the people down at the University of Cincinnati and some of the people, or down at the City of Cincinnati and some of the people at Missouri and some of the people at Iowa State College. He just didn't fit into the conception that most of these institutions had of what a engineering college administrator should be. He had an idea that he was a sort of a little czar that could have everything and do everything that he wanted without any objection or participation in the faculty. And of course he split the faculty into two groups, the one group which supported Johnson and the other group which did not support him.
Well, I understand that the group that didn't support him had sort of committee meetings, is that correct?
That's right.
Well, how did this end up?
It ended up at the end with Mr. Friend being authorized by the Board of Regents to dismiss Johnson as dean of the College of Engineering.
Well, that's when Fred became president. In the meantime, however, I think you discussed a battle, maybe you could call it, between Bennett and Dykstra. What would that have been about?
Well, that was just an outward expression of Professor Bennett's disgust and contempt, I think you might say it was, over the way Dykstra and Johnson had handled a lot of things.
I see. Well, you
of course, there were some situations about the faculty groups which didn't support Johnson. Of course, they didn't get any salary changes. He tried to penalize them that way. And he was, I think, more or less of the opinion that by threatening people, he could get exactly what he wanted. I was told at Iowa State College he did that quite well with the wives of the faculty people.
Oh?
He wouldn't call a faculty meeting, he'd have a meeting of the faculty wives. And some of the people who were there, I think, related to us that he was sort of heavy-handed in telling the faculty what their husbands had to do if they wanted to stay there. Well, of course, Iowa State wasn't that kind of an institution, and he didn't get along too well.
Am I correct in remembering that you said in connection with this sort of committee of people who opposed Johnson that Dykstra even had a detective watching them?
I don't know that he was a professional detective, but he was somebody that Dykstra had that kept in close touch with what the committee did. And when he told us that, told it to me one day. Well, I said, that's nothing. Why don't you come to the meetings? We'll invite you to come to our meetings and let you know when and where we're going to meet. You don't have to be under the table about it.
What was Dykstra's response to that?
I don't remember what he said, but...
He didn't come?
No.
I see. Well, what were some of the things that you personally experienced from Johnson?
Well, I had a defensive background, having very, very close contacts with many of the industries and a lot of the engineers in the state of Wisconsin. So he didn't get very far with some of the bluffs that he...
Well, I do recall you mentioned threatening to take your office away, and was that the case? He didn't get away with it, I assume.
He stood right in that door down there and told me that.
And so I think you also said something about having wastebaskets and mailboxes watched. Am I correct in remembering that?
I think that's the information we got from some of the men that collected the waste paper. Somebody watching the mailboxes.
Well, it must have been a great relief when you had a change.
And there were a lot. there were a lot of other things that were just extremely irritating and
I believe you suggested some time ago that you had some background information on the region's efforts to find a successor to President Dykstra. Would you go into that?
Who was the lady regent from Portage? Zona Gale?
Zona Gale, yes.
Well, the story goes, I think this came from her. At least it was in the newspaper. that when the committee decided to offer this job to Glenn Frank, before Glenn Frank came, Roscoe Pond had been considered. You know who Roscoe Pond
was?
He was a dean of the law school at Harvard, I believe. Well, the Regents had decided to offer Roscoe Pond the job. And the committee went back. Went back to Cambridge to talk to Pond about it. And apparently, Pond said he would accept. And that appeared in our papers that he had accepted. Well, the story goes that after the Regent visit to Cambridge had been completed, the committee went back to New York. And I think it was Ona Gale. That's just a guess, but I think that's who it was. Said she wondered if Mr. Pond understood the conditions under which he was coming to Wisconsin. I'm going back to Boston to talk to him about it. Which he did, according to this story. And when Roscoe Pond found out that he was to be subservient to the La Follettes, the expression used in the paper came from him. He said he had absolutely nothing to do with it. He didn't want anything to do with any restrictions. If he came out here, he said, you better get somebody else.
So that was the end of that.
Haven't you heard that before?
No.
Well, that was published in the Madison paper. Knowing Zona Gale's attitude towards Glenn Frank, Zona Gale's attitude, I'm not surprised at all. She had that fear that Pond couldn't get along. Roscoe Pond was one of the outstanding people in this country. He used to be at the University of Nebraska before he went to Harvard. He was a lawyer. And his sister was in the English department at Nebraska. She was quite an author. So there are a lot of these things that are not in the written history of the university that really happened.
Well, that's what I'm interested in, what's not in the written history. Well, so Pound refused to
come. Pound didn't have anything to do with it, Glenn Frank or with that.
No, but he, if they considered him first.
I don't know that he was before Glenn Frank or not. I wouldn't be surprised. We can probably find out in the files of the newspapers. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any of those. Well, all my books are at home. I haven't seen any of that reference to the, to the Roscoe Pond affair in any of the publications. It may be, I must have missed it.
Well, I hadn't heard of it, but. That's only one possibility. Well, so Glenn Frank came.
I had dinner with Glenn Frank the night before he was killed.
Oh. Were you...
At Wisconsin Rapids.
Yes, in an automobile accident.
At the Dells, Wisconsin Dells.
Yes, in an accident. He and his son.
Automobile accident.
How well did you know him?
I knew Glenn Frank pretty well.
Did you know him before he came?
No. What? Seen him. Heard him, but I didn't know him when he came here very well. Well, I got to know him a little better through my brother down at Purdue.
Oh, yes.
I remember an occurrence which happened between Glenn Frank and Louis Collenberg.
Collenberg?
Do you know Louis?
I didn't know him. I know of him.
We were having a faculty meeting and something came up which apparently there was going to be a long, drawn-out discussion, and somebody suggested that they postpone the meeting and have another special meeting to discuss this question. And Louis Collenberg held up his hand. He said, Mr. President, if we have a special meeting to consider this, will you be there instead of running around the country making speeches at $50 a night? That Louis Kahlenberg affair was quite a case during the First World War. They wanted to hang Louis.
What for?
He was, of course, he was a dyed-in-the-wool world German.
Oh, yes, I do recall that.
And they got him into quite a pickle, and it looked as if they were going to fire him here. Because Louis wasn't too judicious about some of the things he did or said. But I was called over to Milwaukee to attend a meeting of the Board of Visitors on the Louis Kahlenberg case. I think they called me over because I knew Louis pretty well. And I think if it hadn't been for that activity, Louis may have been fired.
It was that close?
Oh, it was. But we saved Louis's hide. Yeah, I got to know Louis very, very well. He was a great prohibitionist. I was quite active in the technical club at that time, and we had a request to have a program on the manufacture of beer. And there was one of Louis' graduates who was over chief chemist at the Slitz Brewing Company. And through Louis, we got him to come over and talk to the technical club. The first thing that happened at the meeting was he presented everybody with a bottle of beer. Louis was running the meeting, and he didn't know what to do because he was 100% anti-beer. There was.
Oh. Not much he could do, was there?
But Louis was enough of a sport though to go along with it.
While we're talking about Glenn Frank, it just occurred to me that to wonder what your attitude about the experimental college was.
Well, what?
The experimental college, which was...
I missed that.
The experimental, what you thought of the experimental college.
Oh,
which,
I didn't know too much about that.
Because when Glenn Frank came and, Mickeljohn came and, no. And this...
I didn't know too much about that, although I knew a good many of the people there in the college. We used to have a table down the university club. Oh, Dick used to come down there too once in a while.
Oh, he still does?
Yeah. And Ellery Leonard, through Ellery Leonard and some of the others, we learned a lot about the experimental college.
Well, what sort of things did you
But I didn't know anything about it personally. No contact with it.
Just what other people were discussing?
We were trying to, at that time, we were trying to get more and more of the so-called liberal courses into the College of Engineering. And I think we did take some advantage of what was being done on the experimental college. We got a course organized, which we call the Contemporary Trends, which I think, I don't know how much, whether the experimental college had anything to do with it or not, but that was one of the first efforts we made to get some more liberal flavoring into our offerings over here.
Did Farrington Daniels have something to do with that?
I don't, who?
Farrington Daniels.
I don't know.
I've heard of Contemporary Trends. I'd have to look up and see who was involved.
He was one of our very good friends over here. She's still alive, isn't she?
Yes, she is. And she's, I don't know whether she's finished it now. She was working on a sort of editing job of his papers some years back. She used to come over to the archives and work, and she had a young man who was assisting her.
Well, he was a top-notch individual. I liked him very much. He knew more about solar energy than some of the people today do.
He was very interested in it, I understand.
He was.
Well, it's too bad he wasn't around to see what developments are going on in this.
Well, there's only one life per person.
True. Well, how about the, while we're still back on Glenn Frank, since you said that Follett had brought him here, do you know anything about the details of his being fired?
No, I don't. Well, it was the newspaper report.
Oh, yes. I've read quite a bit. I wondered if you had any
newspaper report of that.
Any special information about that?
I have a sneaking suspicion he probably would have been elected to the Senate had he not been killed.
Well, that's right. He was campaigning for that, wasn't he?
And he is a master speechmaker.
I've heard that.
Did you ever see his notebook?
No.
Well, that was very interesting. He had a notebook full of paragraphs. And when he wanted to go out and speak to a bunch of blacksmiths, he would pick out certain paragraphs and assemble them. He wanted to talk to a group of medical people, he'd pick out other paragraphs and assemble them. And that's why he could get in so many different groups and use the same speech.
Oh. just edit a little bit.
Well, he used to come down to the University Club quite often. He was quite interesting.
You went to the University Club quite a lot.
Yeah, I used to go there every day when I went home. And when I had the old building, in fact, I was eating breakfast in the University Club the morning we got news that the First World War had started.
Oh my.
That was, I believe, in August of 1914.
Now that's before they were in the present building?
Well, they were in the old residential building then, which the club occupied. And of course, when they revamped it, put on the addition, they changed it somewhat.
Well, there's one other thing I want to know about. While we're talking, going back again to facilities, can you tell me a little bit about getting your new building?
This building?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you a lot about that.
Okay.
As a result of our activities and going around visiting industries and engineering groups, particularly the engineers side of Milwaukee, it was quite evident that we needed a new building. So we were over in the old building. Well, finally, we got this sawtooth construction portion of the building built over here. And it stuck out here like a tent in the desert.
Well, that lower section there that you're pointing to?
The sawtooth.
Oh, yes, I see.
That was the center section. That was here before the rest of the building.
I see.
And that was used for quite a number of years. Just stood out there like a sore thumb. Well, then we started a campaign to get a new building. And the engineer side of Milwaukee was keenly interested in it. We had a number of graduates over there in the society. So we just organized a campaign to get this building. And we did such a good job that when we went to the legislature, we could have had almost anything we wanted.
Great.
So they decided to build this building, and they built it around the sawtooth section. We covered up. And we made some slips, and we got a lot of gifts. When we used to have a traveling crane over in that building for the foundry, which is not there anymore. And one day the dean called me in and said, we forgot this crane. We didn't, didn't get anybody to give us a crane. What can we do about it? Well, I said, I'll go and talk to Harness Schrager about it.
Who?
Harness Schrager. He's a Harness Schrager of the P&H company in Milwaukee. They build traveling cranes. I went over and talked to him, and I talked him into giving us a crane.
Just as a gift?
Just as a gift. And that got us in bed with his son, who didn't want to get to it. If we had so many friends in the engineer side of Milwaukee that anything we wanted, why, we just went after it.
Well, now, so the sections that I see, is this, there's more to the building than what we're in that other wing, isn't there?
Oh, they moved this building after the war. They moved those buildings down from up near Baraboo. We put the cafeteria over there, and there's some offices over there, and a couple of buildings east here. Temporary buildings for 50 years.
Was this after World War II or after
mm-hmm.
World War I?
And we had a camp over here, remember, the trailer camp?
Oh, yes.
Where the people lived.
Well, and they had Badger Village, too, to
Badger
take
Village,
care of the
yeah.
overflow.
Mm-hmm. Once in a while, I get an inquiry from somebody about, did you know anything about this instructor that got killed over in the old engineering building? I said, sure, I know him. He's a student of mine at the University of Nebraska. But once in a while, somebody will come along and ask about that. I'm stuck with it, got killed.
How did that come about?
Oh, he got his, I think he got his jacket intertwined with something on one of the flywheels and one of the engines over there. And it killed him.
Pity.
I knew the boy at Nebraska, so. Boy by the name of Miller. I don't think there's any, I haven't seen any reference to that in any of the books from the university.
No, neither have I. What was his first name?
I don't recall what his name was. I don't recall what his name was.
Was he a student?
No, he was an instructor.
He was an instructor, that's mm-hmm. right, you did say that.
Yeah, he was an instructor. I had him as a student out of Nebraska, so that's what happened to know him.
How adequate have you found these facilities?
This has been a good, practical building all the way through. They've done some things, they've remodeled a wing over here, and they've just completed some remodeling over here on the front lobby to provide some office space up above.
I noticed them doing some work there.
But this is a good, practical building. It's worked out very well. See, this building was built for conditions that existed at the time, and now the requirements are somewhat different. The building changes have to be made.
But still basically
I think this
suitable.
Is one of the I've been to most of the engineering colleges in the United States, and I don't know if any of them got any better facilities than we have here. Maybe a little more elaborate, but conditions here are very good. We've always had at the University of Wisconsin, I think our faculties here have been top-notch all the way through. You remember Danny Mead?
Mm-hmm.
Danny helped build the Hoover Dam.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah. Danny would go out to Las Vegas, spend 3 or 4 days out there, take a lot of pictures, come back home, make slides of them, show them to his class the next day.
Hey.
Oh, he was a powerful individual.
I'm not sure what the time period of this is, but when I talked to you a number of years ago, and you brought up the question of a Red Gym meeting, and under that I have something about the Emma Goldman controversy.
I remember that night. That's a long time ago.
Well, I'm interested in a long time ago. Perhaps we should wait and let me turn the tape over.
I don't remember what year that was, but that was a long, long time ago. She spoke on the Old Red Gym. That's where I first heard Glenn Frank the first time over there.
The Red Gym?
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of university history connected with the Red Gym.
Well, I hope they maintain that building. In spite of a lot of people want to tear it down, I think we ought to maintain some of these old landmarks.
Well, they've started to. They've just renovated the front entry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've been by there and noticed. They took that little front superstructure
mm-hmm.
off the door and made the entry on the outside look the way it used to, and they've moved the sort of storm section inside, and they've really done a nice job.
Well, I think they ought to. I don't believe in tearing buildings down just because of their age.
They've also put an elevator in there.
Well, they have.
They've been at it for a little. Well, they just finished in just before Christmas.
It
started last spring.
That's a sign of improvement.
Well, I think they had to do it for the handicapped.
Mm-hmm.
But they did it. It took them a long time, and there was a lot of mess.
Well, at least it's some indication they're not planning to tear it down.
That's what I think. Though there's more renovating they could do. Well, getting back to Emma Goldman, what was the problem about?
She was an anarchist.
And people didn't want her speaking?
Didn't want her. They thought that was an insult to bring Emma Goldman here.
Well, who fussed about it?
Oh, the general public, people around the university. There was a lot of anarchist feeling at that time. Have you read very much about her?
No, I haven't.
Well, she was a rip-snorting anarchist that wanted to wreck everything.
Was she allowed to speak?
I believe she was, yeah.
Well, that's,
I remember,
that's good.
I don't think I went to hear her because I didn't think at that time that she'd permit her to speak. But with the liberal traditions we have around here, everybody ought to be given his day.
Well, let's hope. Well, I do know that later on, I imagine it was quite a bit later, there was the same sort of objection to having communist speakers come.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were unusually anti-Emma Goldman.
A lot of other things went on in the Red Gym. Didn't they used to have faculty meetings there?
I never attended a faculty meeting here.
Oh, you didn't?
No, we used to meet over in the law building. And we had one Howard Smith who used to keep the faculty meetings lively.
How did he do that?
There's a picture of him down the university club. He could put life into a faculty meeting by getting up and making a proposal or asking a question. You'll never forget a faculty meeting if he was there.
Well, some of them must have been pretty dull.
But he livened them up.
Now, there are a number of other questions I have.
You reminded me of something about a meeting we had down the governor's office. Apparently the governor was making a proposal to do something with our funds. And Mark Engel and I were down there. And apparently they were going to give us a course in annuities, annuity calculations, all that sort of thing. This chap, I think he was a member of the legislature, although I wouldn't say so. He began to pontificate about all these things. He didn't know who Mark Ingram was. And Mark began to ask him some questions. Of course, Mark knew more about the mathematics of annuities than I guess anybody in the United States. This chap didn't know that. Mark had a lot of fun with him by asking him questions he couldn't answer.
That's nice.
I see that business is up again. They want to take some of that money and invest in farms.
Yes.
Well, we had several real, real long meetings on that question down there. You had to keep a watch on everything they did down there. An active lobby down at the Capitol opposing it. Even had a booth set up down there in that Capitol building.
Well,
that was afloat.
The immediate
cause of the reason for the meeting was the fact that the state was reneging on making their legal contributions to the retirement system each year. You were getting behind in it, and we were insisting that the state make the contributions, because you see, the money was invested in it. The interest came back to the retirement, to the investment board.
I see.
And then we had another session at one time when they were trying to put some of our teachers' retirement board funds into farm mortgages in the northern part of the state, and I think we burned our fingers once or twice on that.
How do you mean?
Well, we lost some money. I don't know what the amount of it was, but there was a tendency on the part of some of the legislators to believe that that money was state money and they could spend it any way they desire. They didn't realize the fact that the funds belonged to the teachers of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And after a long battle, we got the state to make up their back payments, and we were then even.
Oh, well, that's good.
That was quite a battle we had, and Mark Ingram just did a monumental job of getting that straightened out for us. He probably is one of the outstanding men in the United States on this matter of retirement finances. You know, he's had a lot of consulting jobs, if you call them that. He went to Canada to help them out with their retirement system up there.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Yes. They published, I think, some of the work he did up there. I remember seeing a rough copy of it, but I'm not too familiar with it.
Well, I know he's been involved with this for a long time, even past retirement.
He did. He's still interested in it.
Past his retirement.
Mm-hmm. He's still interested in it.
Well, now, let's see. I guess I'd like to go back a little bit to some other things that we might talk about. I know you were somewhat involved, maybe considerably, in the centennial celebration activities. I wonder if you'd tell me what you recall about that.
I don't know as I recall very much about my activities in connection with the centennial. That was in 1948.
You gave a Founders Day speech in Missouri in 1949, which had something to do with it. I imagine they celebrated it.
Oh, I was doing considerable traveling for the Alumni Association, and I went to a number of places,
mm-hmm.
St. Louis, Pittsburgh.
Well, in that year, you had an Engineers' Day, which you were in charge of, I've heard, and was...
That's when we started the Engineers' Day, which has now become traditional at the college.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. How did you happen to think of this?
Well, I was doing a lot of traveling around the state, visiting industries particularly for the engineering college in the Extension Division. And it occurred to us, there was a committee, I don't recall all the members of the committee, I think Professor Woodburn was one, Professor Hogan was another.
Professor Woodburn?
Woodburn.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that other schools had been having a so-called Engineers' Day in which they recognized certain of the alumni and others, industrialists, who had made contributions to the university. So we started our first Engineers' Day in Madison. And most of the people were, first Engineers' Day was in Milwaukee.
Oh.
Glenn Frank was president then, I believe, or E.B. Fred was president then, I believe.
Yes, because he became president in 1945, and this was 1949.
And we recognized at that time, I think there were four men from the Wisconsin Electric Power Company. I think three of the four, I believe, were graduates. And I'm not quite certain of this because I don't have the list here. But that's where we started the Engineer Day activity. We had quite an interesting time with that particular program because we had arranged for the Pro Arte Quartet to provide the entertainment for us at the Schrader Hotel. And a few days, maybe a week before we were to have this Engineers' Day meeting, the union notified us that they would not permit the Pro Arte Quartet to appear at the Schrader Hotel.
Why was that?
They thought it was interfering with their prerogatives or something of the kind over there. So President Fred got in touch with Petrillo. Remember Petrillo, the music czar in Chicago? And they tried to settle the thing so that we didn't have any trouble. We didn't want to cancel the program at the last minute. So Petrillo, I guess, talked to the union people in Milwaukee, and between President Fred and Petrillo, they come to an arrangement, which was a rather peculiar thing. It was agreed that they would permit the Pro Arte Quartet to appear. Well, in the meantime, one or two of the members of the quartet were members of the union, and they got sort of disgusted about it. So if I remember correctly, maybe two of them, resigned from the union.
Oh.
But we did get the quartet over to the meeting at Milwaukee. With a there were two provisions in the agreement. One was that the union be permitted to have a stand-in for each member of the quartet on the platform during the program.
What was the purpose of this?
Well, this is... The peculiar thing was that how meticulous the members of the Pro Arte Quartet, they were always dressed and everything right up to the peak of everything. The four stand-ins they sent over looked like a bunch of bums. And they sat up there on the platform with these Pro Arte Quartet people.
And they didn't have any function except to sit there?
Just be there. And, in addition, they required that President Fred read a statement which they had prepared to the audience, which was was foolish and stupid all the way through, but President Fred made it and got the thing straightened out. But we thought we were having trouble getting that first meeting started, but after talking to the hotel people over there, I thought we were kind of lucky. Because some of the other organizations had a lot of trouble.
Oh, I see.
I think I don't know how strong the union is over there now, but they certainly dominated things for a long time.
What else besides the quartet was involved in engineers in that first Engineers' Day?
Well, we presented, we had the Board of Regents were represented, and the President of the University was represented. I'm not sure whether the governor was there or not. our records would indicate that. But it was a recognition that these four people had contributed materially to the welfare of the university. They were all engineers. And that has continued over the years ever since. That was a recommendation, the institution of the Engineers Day was a recommendation of our committee.
I see. Well, did you have any exhibits or anything along with this?
No.
What, now you say this is continued.
That's continued. We have it each year
really?
Now.
Mm-hmm. What makes up the program for the ones that you have nowadays?
Well, usually one or more of the recipients of the citations are usually make some remarks, but it's pretty largely a recognition dinner. And usually the president of the regents or the president of the university or the chancellor present the citations to these people.
I see.
Now that effort to build up cooperation between the industries and the university, I think, has succeeded very well. And the present administration of the College of Engineering is pushing it.
Well, I know you mentioned last time we talked that in the early days, industry really wasn't very impressed with
they weren't.
of engineering. Well, let's see. We haven't talked about another thing that I'm interested in, which is the engineering experiment station. And I'm wondering what relationship
Well, that's something I had very little contact with, excepting that we did get some small contributions from certain industries to carry on certain experiments. At the university, the experiment station was not too well organized at that time, not like it is at the present time. But I had very little to do with that, excepting building up contacts between industry and the university.
I see. Well, what kind of relationship existed and exists between mechanical engineering and the experiment station?
Well, excepting that I think it's pretty safe to say the experiment station was more or less a paper organization at that time, but the work was carried on in the departments.
Oh, I see.
In the departments, and they were all grouped together under the experiment station. You see, the result of it was the building of this building over here. This engineering research building.
I see.
So it worked out very well eventually.
Well, how did this develop, do you know?
Oh, well, at the very beginning, XY company would say, we have a problem. Do you have anyone down there that could work on this problem, a graduate student? Particularly, or a faculty man, if we make a contribution to finance this, could it be done? That was the genesis of it at the beginning. And of course, more and more companies saw what was going on and they contributed. Research Products Corporation out here was one of the first. Benjamin Reynolds, who was a graduate in chemical engineering, made a financial contribution to the university, which provides a financial reward each year, which is given to an outstanding teacher in the College of Engineering. Not necessarily in the College of Engineering, it may be in some of the other chemistry, physics, or in some of the other scientific areas.
I see.
But I didn't have too much contact with the experience station, excepting when I had a chance to help them out through these contacts with industry.
I see.
One of the prime objectives in visiting the industries that time was to get their reaction to what's going on in the College of Engineering and to build up a working relationship between not only the companies, but the personnel in the companies with the people down at the university. There was not too much contact at the beginning.
No, there wasn't.
Which you could expect.
I see.
But I think that's been very well developed now, and we have good contacts with most of the companies.
That is a change, I guess.
We have as good an arrangement for that as we ever you'll find in any schools.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that does represent quite a change over the years, doesn't it?
Well, the development of this Engineer's Day is a story in itself. That could be written up in good style if somebody would do it.
It sounds from what you say as though this may have had something to do with the relationships between the university and industry.
Oh, it did. We got them down here, and then at the same time we started, that was the start of the short courses. We decided we'd have a 3 or 4 day short course, which our faculty would participate in. We'd get the company to send certain of their people down here. And I remember when the Sawtooth Building was first constructed over here, we had a short course for welders, which was welding was fairly new then. And that was the beginning of the contact between the companies and the people at the college who were interested in welding. Well, that now has been almost expanded, so they have contacts outside of Wisconsin in great numbers.
Oh, so people come from other states?
They did.
Do they still?
Sometime. But this short course is developing, and then the extension division took over most of it at the present time.
Was this originally associated with Engineer's Day, or was it a separate?
Oh, no, that was something that was just one of these side developments of establishing good working relationships with the industries of the state.
I see. Well, while we're talking about relationships, this is on a lighter vein, what do you know about the origin of the rivalry between the law school and the School of Engineering?
For some reason or other, that exists in practically every engineering college in the United States where they also have a law school on the campus.
I didn't realize that. I thought it was unique to us.
Oh, no. That goes on in every place. I was down at the University of Louisville when they were building a new engineering building and a new law building. University of Louisville is one of the oldest state universities in the United States. I was telling the dean they made one great mistake because they located the engineering building right across the street from the law school building. No, but that existed in practically all schools on the assumption that St. Patrick was an engineer.
Well, I've heard the song that's sung here.
I remember one day I had a boy in class, and he came up and wanted to know if he could have about 10 minutes to make a little talk to the members of the class, in which he proved that St. Patrick was not an engineer.
Oh.
But we still assume he was.
I see.
No, that goes on practically all engineering schools.
Why, what's the basis of this idea that St. Patrick was an engineer?
I think it was just originating to have something to do and take it out on the lawyers. It's been interesting if you go over all the engineers' days, all of the St. Patrick's Day celebration here, the engineers in the law school, people were lined up against each other. But you notice that whenever either of them got into difficulty, the other ones came to their help.
Oh, that's good. Did this, had this, was this going on when you first came, or did it develop?
Oh, no, it's a long time. I think it reached the point of destructiveness. Just before Kurt Wendt became dean, and he was more or less responsible for killing the St. Patrick's Day parade.
Oh, yes, where that was quite a tradition.
Where there was so much destruction taking place.
How did he do that?
Well, we just put Engineers' Day in its place. I think Engineers' Day took the place of the... And the fraternities still have little activities of their own.
Well, but the parade that got not happened.
That parade was... The result of that play, there were a great many stories and events culminated. I have a lot of personal stories about that parade and various people in it.
What, could you give a few?
I can give you one. There was one of our circuit judges by the name of Goldmar, Robert Goldmar from Baraboo. He's now retired and is a substitute judge living down in Elkhorn.
Okay.
Bob came in to see me one day. He had a metallurgical problem with one of his clients up in Baraboo. And I said, well, we can get you the information. So we went over to see Professor McCaffrey over in the mining and metallurgy. And we got him lined up. And I said, Bob, do you remember the day you were standing down at the top of the midway lunch on State Street with a basket full of decayed eggs, throwing them down on the engineer's parade that went by? You have the gumption to come down here and ask us to help you now. He was a good personal friend of mine.
I see.
I still see him quite often.
Well, did you help?
He did. You know, this matter of developing friendships and contacts with people in the industries and people all over the state, I think has been very, very good in this state. I think we have better contacts than they have in most states.
Has this been true all the time you've been here, or do you think it's been getting better?
Oh, it's been getting better. It's been getting better because we've been working at it.
Well, I know that particularly during the presidency of E.B. Fred, the university was held in pretty high esteem around the state.
Well, it is. It is. But there was a time when it wasn't too especially good.
Well, I think there was a falling off during the late 60s when all the protests were going on.
When they let the political situation in the state interfere with the university, I think that was unfortunate. That's been pretty largely overcome now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the climate seems to be somewhat different now.
Most of that emanated, I think, from the fact that during the war Follett didn't think the people at the university had supported his anti-war stand as much as they might, and they got out that famous petition, which I think just sparked a lot of the animosity toward the university.
Well, and I was thinking later on of during the war in Southeast Asia, of the protests on the campus, students got out of hand.
Well, that was just a change, I think, that occurred all over the country. Some schools didn't have the same trouble we had here.
Well, some had more, if you think of Kent State, for instance.
Oh, well, I think that's just a breakdown in the recognition on the part of some of the students that they have an obligation to obey the rules and regulations of their institution.
Well, of course, we're not in that war anymore, and the attitude of students on the campus today seems to be much more serious.
It's changed materially. You can see that.
Yes, I think.
You can see it in their dress and in their conduct, and practically all their contacts with the university are different than they used to be.
I don't think anybody regrets this change.
Maybe it was one of those things that just had to get out of their system, but. I just read an editorial in a magazine last night called Dangers Ahead, in which it discusses some of these things we've been mentioning on the part of the students.
Well, let's. I think I'd like to get back to talking about the department a bit. You did. I guess I did ask you about how the three different or four different kinds of engineerings got along with one another and cooperated with one another. And you
well, I think that's all. It all struck me that that's been top notch in this department, in this College of Engineering. I think the relationships have been very, very good. You can't get a large group of men without having some irritation at times about things. But.
Well, I know you were chairman of the Department of Mechanical Engineering for a time. Can we talk about that some? Like what you recall of your experiences as chairman, what issues came up and how they worked out?
Well, that job was hooked onto me while I was away one year.